You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
City Limits. Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9 a.m.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Okay, City Limits, and we're on the third Wednesday of the month. It's our normal housing day, so we'll be talking a bit of housing later in the show with lawyer Max Costello. We're going to talk to Max today about a number of things, the Refugee Convention. We're going to talk to him about civil rights. Max is a retired lawyer, but he spent years working in civil rights, particularly with refugees. And he also, one of the rights we're supposed to give people is housing, and we'll
Would
be discussing
it?
That as well. Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? Normally on this day we have the Housing for the Aged Action Group, but they're not able to make it this month, or nor next month for that matter, so we're going to miss them for a couple of months, but they'll be back after that, so all shall be well. And I'm Kevin Healy, by the way. That was Anne Maxwell who made a noise on the other side there. And I'm going to pour some tea. We've got Keep the Fire Burning Black, Loud and Proud, one cup. And we've got One Dimension. I don't know, are you a boys band type person?
I might leave you with One Dimension there, Kevin.
Oh, you're going to go Black, Loud and Proud,
that.
Are you?
Yes, I will.
Okay. Well,
quite
there you
proudly.
Are.
Thank you.
Well, this is Taekwon tea, or it's called today. This is a different one anyway.
Ooh, yeah. Different tea, not the Chinese tea.
Oh, there you are. It's quite nice. There you are. That's it.
Oh, that's good.
Now, I noticed when I came in the door this morning and your car parked out the side there.
Uh-huh. Did you?
And I didn't realise you're quite as rich as you are because while it was attacked by car aficionados, as you know, how dare Ferrari have an electric car, the first one off the block sold at auction this week for, what do you reckon it sold for? First electric Ferrari went
I'd
to auction.
I would pay to get
what
the
did,
first
What did you
one?
Pay for it?
That's a collector's item. I would pay $5 million.
Right, well, it went for $56.5 million. you're 51 and a half short.
Car inflation has gotten away on me, Kevin.
51 and a half short.
Oh, Lordy.
But I noticed you at the front there, so obviously you came up with the money. There you are. That's
it. Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Is he spending 51 and a half for a car?
I just added an extra zero on the end of the check.
Yeah, for God's sake. Anyway, look, I've got some sad news again, though.
Okay.
Mentioned this last week, but I just want to repeat it because it hasn't got better. The Alan Joyce book is still not moving. It's very, very,
it's
very,
a bit
very
stuck, is it?
Very, very slow sales.
Well, that's too bad.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone caught an item recently in The Age about police violence in Gippsland, and they named a number of cases, but. A bloke called Holt, Brodie Holt, suffered, this is back in May 2022, suffered permanent brain damage after an alleged violent assault by police. Daryl Ivory from Traralgon. Ivory has accused three officers of unlawfully arresting him and dousing him with capsicum spray despite complying with police. Jai Smith Good. Just hours later, Smith Good was allegedly hogtied during an alleged violent arrest by same officers. Warrigal man Senior Constable Aaron Bowen doused a man with capsicum spray and tasered him 9 times in less than a minute soon after entering the victim's home. And Peter Walker alleges he was unlawfully arrested by officers who pointed a taser at him despite his compliance. And Constable Bowen, Aaron Bowen, has become the first constable in Victoria to be charged over deployment of a taser. Body camera footage captured Bowen dousing the man in the face with capsicum spray and using a taser 9 times in 46 seconds. And he was convicted and fined $11,000 and has been suspended without pay, but he's still during an internal investigation. and et cetera, et cetera. But it's just typical, we get it even at rallies and things, but it's pretty awful. But I'm wondering whether it doesn't sort of emanate from the top, because the police commissioner, Mike Bush, says he sympathises with parents whose children have been caught up in crime, while advocating a less bail, more jail mantra for the low lives who commit them. So when the chief of coppers says less bail, more jail for low lives, you think, well, I suppose it catches down the line somewhere, doesn't it?
What an attitude. So this is all coming out of the same area, all these cases. So there's a bit of a culture there.
Down that part of the world, yeah. Now, we have to give some credit to Pat Conroy, who's sort of a junior minister of some sort. He's defence industry minister, but he's supposed to, he's on the left of the Labor Party. Well, I've never heard him talk about anything else but war and weapons and killing people. But anyway, Pat, he clarified a situation, because we know that HMAS Stirling in Western Australia is where American submarines and troops and are circulating. They call it rotation. It means they occupy our land. I think that's what it means, which we occupy in turn from the people who originally had the land. It's, you know, you work your way back. But nonetheless, Pat Conroy said that in fact the rotation of US submarines was limited to just 5 years. Now, the Home Affairs Department Secretary and covers accused him of evicting the Americans before they arrived, which is a terrible thing to say. But then the Americans set him straight. They said, "We are here to stay." So Pat sorted that one out and said, "Just want to clarify that the Americans are here to stay."
Did he actually say that?
Well, more or less.
Reading between the lines, that's what he said.
Yeah, that's right. Pat clarified that he made a bit of a blue and, you know.
Oops.
didn't get his orders right. So there you are. But meanwhile, on that appropriately named Truth Social of Donald Trump's, which is a most accurate title, I would have thought. He says that America, this rumours about having running out of ammunition and things to kill people with is simply not true.
Okay.
We got plenty of it, massive amounts, he said. The same day, unfortunately, the Pentagon ordered the Merchants of Death to speed up their production because they're running out. Now, it's strange.
Someone's got their wires crossed.
Yeah, must have got their wires crossed. But it turns out in the first month of the Iran war, the US fired off more than 850 Tomahawk cruise missiles and more than 1,000 Patriot and Thaad interceptors, whatever they are. It also used more than 1,300 of the Army's tactical ballistic missiles in the initial weeks of fighting. And the global inventory of Patriot missiles has fallen from 2,200 before the war to fewer than 827, and Thaad missiles from 452 to fewer than 278, et cetera, et cetera. But what that shows is the massive amount of stuff they've been pouring on Iran and the devastation. So Iran's doing a pretty good job standing up to it all, actually, at this stage. But anyway, Donald says they've got plenty. The Pentagon says, speed it up, we haven't got much. And also, they are spending millions and millions and millions on defence, so it's not, not all too bad. But also on Truth Social, it's a bit of a blue taking place in America at the moment, because Truth Social is where Donald often, overnight rants and raves and puts out all these ridiculous things, and sort of what might be policy tonight is a different one tomorrow night. And, minute by minute, he's either going to bomb Iran or we're talking and they want to talk, they want to make a deal.
I'm not subscribed to his account, I have to admit.
Yeah, it's minute by minute stuff. But anyway, he's charging $1.7 million a year for people to have access, priority access to his Truth Social. Now, incredibly, there's a mob taking him to court over this, saying that the plaintiffs argued that the plan was at odds with the US Constitution's First Amendment and its protection of freedom of speech and of the press. They argued the First Amendment guaranteed equal access to the president's public announcements.
Mm.
A president selling... Now, this is a silly thing. This just doesn't make sense. Listen to this. A president selling priority access to news he himself generates for the benefit of a private company he controls is so blatantly corrupt and unconstitutional that it would have been hard to even fathom just a few years ago, said Seth Stern, chief of advocacy at Freedom of the Press Foundation. Now, where'd that come from? I mean, Donald has a right to make a quid, doesn't he? And then it goes on to point out the billions that the Trump family's making through his presidency, but there you are.
After 50 tweets, he could afford one of those cars, one of those Ferraris.
Yeah, easily. In fact, he could probably tweet that they should give him one, which they probably will. Mm.
Don't suggest it, Kevin.
Yeah, no, it's electric, so he wouldn't want it.
Mm.
He wants the petrol version.
That's true. Mm.
Yeah, so that's okay. That's sort of that one out.
Phew.
Now, last week, thank goodness, the federal government agreed, and the New South Wales government, they got together and said they're going to provide $2.5 billion to bail out the Tomago aluminium smelter, which is run, of course, by Rio Tinto.
Our friends Rio Tinto.
Rio Tinto, which a week earlier had announced a $6.5 billion profit in Australia due to the fact that other minerals they sell are going through the roof, so to speak. But obviously they couldn't afford the $2.5 billion to bail out Tomago.
To bail out, yes.
But also then it was revealed on Friday that New South Wales is sort of locked into their amount, but the federal government's contribution is open-ended. And so if electricity prices cost more than they're anticipating or aluminium prices drop, then the federal government's up for more.
Wow, that's a pretty good deal.
Not a bad deal for a company that announces record profits the week before.
Yeah, that's right. They got some good negotiators there.
Yes, and... they're also screaming and yelling, of course, about the changes in the budget to trusts.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the part that I think will upset you enormously.
Probably.
Innes Willocks, one of our very favourite people from the Australian Industry Profits Group.
Mm-hmm.
Innes, he was aghast last week.
He was aghast, was he?
He's gasping for breath.
Okay.
He said the budget decision to impose a minimum 30% tax on discretionary trusts would affect 494,000 businesses currently structured through trusts. This is terrible.
Mm.
Most are small businesses and many are currently contemplating changing their ownership arrangements, and it's going to cost them, he points out, it's going to cost them millions, or a lot of money anyway, to rearrange themselves. Now, one can only presume they want to rearrange themselves and
in order to avoid the new tax.
That's right. Yeah.
They want to make sure that they're paying all the tax that they're obliged to pay.
Well, that's what they always say. We are meeting our legal tax obligations.
That's right.
They always meet their legal tax obligations, which is good to know, isn't it?
Mm.
But anyway, that's the problem they now face. They've got to spend money with their tax lawyers and accountants to sort the whole bloody thing out. Which
you
is pretty.
You do have to feel sorry for them, don't you?
Yes. And BHP workers over in Western Australia, where they've gone for decades non-unionised, and now the big companies over there are quite distressed that the unions are moving in.
Mm.
Although as they say, it's always been win-win for the company and the workers. I don't know what they're worried about.
That's gonna
change. But no, that's right. Nothing should change. But anyway. They're quite worried, but last week the number of workers walked off last Sunday week.
Mm, exciting.
The BHP's big concern is this could deter investment in the sector. I mean, people will just stop investing in really important things like coal and gas and other stuff.
Oh, yeah, they'll just stop wanting to
wanting
to buy it or use it or, yep, it will change everything.
So that's, I thought that was pretty sad. Now, also, there's a woman, speaking of the Truth Social thing, there was a long article this week about the business lobbies and the, particularly the Labor Party and Liberal parties, but Labor Party in particular, because it's in government, with their business, the Federal Labor Business Forum, and the millions they rake in from business, which gives business access, of course, to ministers and all sorts of things, and access to the state, to the conferences, and all, but just massive amounts they're bringing in, and a number of lawyers who are, you know, integrity lawyers say, well, one lawyer said, it exemplifies a serious problem in the political system where well-heeled, deep-pocketed business people get access to valuable political opinions by paying substantial amounts of money. It's something which is not available to most of us because most of us can't afford it, and it just gives an advantage to the wealthy over the average person. And if you look at the main industries that are donating the money, you can guess which ones they are, of course. There's
wouldn't be coal, would it? Wouldn't be gas, would it be?
Well, surprise, surprise, yes. And it's gambling as well.
Gambling as well.
All the ones that the government is a bit wary about changing laws for are the ones that are throwing heaps and heaps of money into the pool. Isn't that interesting?
Strange coincidence there, Kevin.
Yeah, and one bloke, a distinguished professor of accounting is described as, Stephen Taylor, talks about the KPMG situation. They're currently, of course, before the Senate, but there's all sorts of inquiries into the fact that they misused information and they also treated the whistleblower who whistleblew so badly. but what's coming out now is actual proof that what they were saying, some of the early inquiries when they had major memory lapses, in fact, are wrong, and that we know what they're all like, these people. But this bloke says that even change the rules they're trying to change to straighten them up will have no effect, he says, because of their, you kind of, it's hard to believe, because of their greed, arrogance, and stupidity.
You can't outlaw greed, arrogance, and stupidity. No, is that the problem?
What a terrible thing to say about these wonderful people. Anyway, that's the awful situation.
They're like a big four, that crowd, aren't they? Like a bit like the banks.
And there's a woman, I'm trying to find the right piece, but I know her name. Her name is Ellen Schlossberg.
Mm-hmm.
I can't find the piece, but I know it. I know on top of my head.
Yeah.
Ellen Schlossberg, American woman. Now, when Peter Malinauskas, the South Australian Premier, who, like our state Premier, is a comes out of the Shop Distributors Association, a very right wing union, when he was in America a couple of weeks ago, he was negotiating around data centres, and he's gone back and now he's set up a royal commission into it, and he wants to attract all these things. He had a meeting, some sort of conference, a meeting with heavies from the data industry and the AI industry, which would have been pretty open-minded and, you know, given all points of view. There was only one spot in the whole thing for a person who was an opponent of the data centres and AI, well, not necessarily AI, but certainly data centres and the impacts on community, a woman called Ellen Schlossberg, who lived an hour away from, I think the meeting was in Washington or New York, one of the two.
Okay.
She took a Uber ride for an hour. And on the way, she just checked the situation, and her status was changed without her being informed from present to not present, and she was barred. And she called it a blunder from down under, I think was her description of what happened. But the organisers of this, the decent thing they did was they paid for the Uber fare.
Okay.
Yeah, but isn't that good of them? But
both ways,
but,
I hope.
Yeah, that's right. But she wasn't allowed to attend. So any voice critical of data centers or AI was the only voice that was going to be Ellen Schlossberg anyway, was going home again in the Uber.
I love it when they
turn around and go home.
Weaponize the meeting rules against you, you know, or change the rules as you're in Yoruba.
Yeah, that's right. But that was the no one said it. She said you might have got an email that she missed, but certainly she only found out by checking on her phone that she was no longer present, so to speak.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yes, that is kind of stooping to low tactics.
It
couldn't
is.
Couldn't even cope with one dissenting voice.
No, and yet we've got governments falling over themselves without explaining to us how we're going to handle the... Well, they claim, you know, they're going to have to provide renewable, but that's a long term. And where they get the water from, well, that's...
The water and the electricity, we already know it's a problem. And the sound, apparently.
That's right. But there's a... There was also a headline in the paper yesterday, written from the point of view of supporting data centres, obviously, public backslash a, and decisive risk is in parentheses, public backlash a decisive risk for data centres. I would have thought that data centres are probably a decisive risk for the public. You know, you could switch that around, couldn't you?
Depends on your point of view, that one, doesn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, securing community approval to build data centres has become a financial risk for developers who must convince Australians how they will benefit from billions of dollars of new projects if they want them to succeed. And it's all pretty terrible, isn't it?
There's something I heard on the grapevine, and I don't know if there's anything in the media about it. But speaking of risk, there's also the risk that a major data centre can become a military target.
I suppose it could, couldn't it? Yeah.
I think the people are already seeing that over in Europe, or considering it anyway. So there's lots of reasons not to love your data centres.
Yes. Don't you love your data centres? Well, of course, they're
not yet, Kevin. I'm working on it.
They're also, of course, being put in working class suburbs, or is that a use of... phrase that we shouldn't use, I don't know, but anyway, certainly they're certainly not being put in the leafy suburbs of eastern Melbourne, for instance.
And don't want a giant blank warehouse taking up blocks and blocks.
No, that's right. But people are backing up and saying, you know, not in our backyard, so to speak, but they don't seem to have much power over it because, of course, governments bring in rules that override the community in terms of these planning decisions anyway. So
they must know something we don't know, Kevin.
No. There's also been a fair bit happening in the area of forests. I was hoping to have more discussion about this, and we'll try and get it on this program in the next week or two. Mm-hmm. But a bloke called DeFegley, who's one of the proponents of the forest industry, had an article about a couple of weeks ago in which he argued that, and this makes a lot of sense, that you should chop down native forests because if you don't, it's bad for the environment. So he argued that chopping down native forests is environmentally good, and that's what you've got to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll have to remember that next time I see a bit of old growth.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. So there's been a bit of a backlash against that argument.
Never.
Yeah, go on. Some people suggest maybe that's not quite the case.
So irrational, Kevin. How can not chopping down your native forest be
it's hard to believe. Anyway, that's his argument. And there's been but there's also someone else came out and sort of half supported him, but then these usual greeny long-haired people, commies come out and they say
those
he's wrong.
Commies.
Yeah, bloody hell. You know, leave the trees in the ground, for God's sake. What use are they in the ground? For God's sake.
That's right. Just standing there blocking the view,
right,
aren't they?
Yeah. Blocking the view of the tree behind them, which you'll have to take down to block the tree. Anyway.
Never ends.
That's right. So that's the go there. But there's also been a big split, it is quite a split actually happening in the environment movement with the Bob Brown Society. And Bob Brown, is that what it's called? Bob Brown Society, I think it is. Yeah. And ACF and others over carbon credits.
Okay.
And one of the big ones is the New South Wales government has set aside a state forest, but it's using it as a repository for carbon credits for carbon industry, where, you know, we all know, you plant a tree, you can pollute to your heart's content.
You can plant a palm oil tree for palm oil.
Now, the argument is this is better than nothing, and it's saving some carbon. But the Bob Brown Society argument is, well, you shouldn't use native forests and native forests as part of the campaign to stop people pollute by using native forests. So there's an argument about some people saying, yes, we should do this because at least it's getting some carbon out of the air, versus those saying, no, this is totally wrong. This is not the use of what a native forest is all about. Mm. So there's quite a dispute
taking place, I think. Yeah. Mm. I don't know. I haven't heard good things about carbon credits, but... Yes.
Well, listen, I don't think you ever will. Other than, you hear them from the industry itself.
Oh, of course, yes.
They'll tell you how wonderful they are. And they certainly are. They just keep polluting.
Creative accounting in another way.
But that little tree is saving the world. So that's very good. And but good news also, because Woodside announced record profits. Well, yes, it did announce record profits.
Oh,
yeah. Which was good, based on the fact that the war in Iran and all the problems with getting stuff around the world means that they're able to get more gas out, because countries that were taking gas that used to come through the Straits of Hormuz, for instance, are now turning to Australia. So while we were selling lots of gas anyway, we're now selling a lot more. Mm. Isn't that wonderful? The transition's going so well.
I can just hear all these hands being rubbed.
Yes, the transition's firing along there. So and New Hope Coal, for the same reason. The coal isn't getting around the world either as much as it was. And so they're, and Asian countries are switching from gas to coal because of this overall problem, some Asian countries. And so New Hope Coal in Australia is also now making heaps and heaps of profit, because they're selling more and more coal, which is so good. Just the only problem with all that is that Mother Earth isn't going so well.
Oh.
No.
Oh, I forgot about that part.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. That's right. And we're certainly seeing it around the world at the moment, everywhere.
Everyone's affected. Like, you can't, like, pretend that it's happening somewhere else.
No. So there you are. I suppose if they're making money, it's good. If they make money, it's good for all of us, isn't it? They keep telling us that.
Hmm. And then they're going to go
you,
off
you
to
You follow
them.
Economics, so you must know this. I mean, surely if Woodside and Rio Tinto make record profits and the government gives them $2.5 billion, so that's terrific.
But, that means we have a strong economy, Kevin, apparently. Right. A very weak-looking future, but a strong economy.
Yeah, ordinary future for Mother Earth, unfortunately, but that's how it goes. Look, we'll take a break here, come back, and we'll have a yarn to Max Costello about heaps of things to do with refugees and with housing and all sorts of things.
All right, stay with us. This is Dan Tuffy with some good advice. Don't smoke in bed.
Sleep out in the rain without an empty bottle of wine. And don't you go sell up on me now. Always speak your mind. Stay away from low-hanging clouds. Don't be carrying no extra lead. Don't be starting a fire with strangers. Don't smoke in bed. Don't smoke in bed. Don't smoke in bed. Don't be riding on the railroad. Unless the trains is running late. And when you ride the boundary fences, always always shut the gate. Try not to spook the horses when you go into the shed. Always leave your shirt on at the table. Don't smoke in bed. Don't smoke in bed. Don't smoke in bed. Bet you're gonna say you just met her, and you can't keep her out of your head. She said you want to wait for the sun come up, even though you've been in matches out the window, lest the wind be on the grass. Beware of children who burn insects with a magnifying glass. Never pick up the telephone in a strange woman's house. Don't you go sell up on me now. Don't smoke in bed. Don't smoke in bed. Don't smoke in bed.
Okay, Max Casello on the line. And Max is a lawyer who worked extensively in human rights issues. And Max, I think we'll start out today because you've written a paper talking about Australia's obligation to refugees, which was sort of ripped up in many ways by Tony Abbott in some ways. Can you outline that for us? And the fact that we signed it way back after World War II.
Yes, we did. And in fact, it was the Menzies government that ratified the Refugees Convention. What Abbott did in a 2014 amending the Migration Act, and this is not long after he came to power, he just overrode quite a few provisions in the convention. But the most notorious one is that section or that provision, that article in the Refugees Convention that prohibits what's called refoulement, that is, returning someone to the very extreme persecution and even threats to their life that they fled from. And in a word, his Migration Act amendment declared that prohibition to be, quote, irrelevant, unquote, even if there had been an individual, that's irrelevant in general, but there was two bits to it. The second bit said that even if a person has been assessed, someone who's about to be deported, assessed and they've found that it would be extremely dangerous to that person if they're sent back, well, that assessment is also, quote, irrelevant. And it's still on the books. Section number 197, capital C, was inserted into the Act. Now, it's been modified. There are a few provisos and exceptions built into it. It's very complicated. But it still says the prohibition on refoulement is irrelevant. What a disgrace.
And indeed, that's one obligation which we seem to ignore. But our whole refugee policy, when you look at what we did sign up for, seems to be run counter to it in many ways. We have a, you know, Kevin Rudd didn't help, of course, with his no one who comes by boat will stay here. We seem to have a pretty, what one might call, cruel attitude to refugees, Max.
Well, and it's getting worse. Is in August 2025, the Labor government put through a series of drastic curtailments of rights, and it was called the Home Affairs Legislation Amendment. But one of the law firms that acts for refugees, the Human Rights Law Centre, in their response to it, they dubbed it not an amending bill, but the anti-fairness bill. They said it would, and it did. I'll just mention two of the three things. Remove the government's duty to give a person notice and an opportunity to respond if they're about to be deported. And the second one was removes the government's duty to give a person notice when issuing them a direction to cooperate with their own deportation. And if they fail to cooperate, they get 12 months in jail, or up to 12 months in jail. I mean, these are just extraordinary, vicious anti-human rights amendments, and they override... we've talked about the Refugees Convention, but there is another major act, which I'll come to, that gives people in Australia a lot of rights, and they're overridden as well.
Which is...
It is called the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. And that was ratified by a Liberal Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, in 1976. And just quickly, it's got so many rights in it that it's got one article says that the parties that sign up to it, or ratify it, Australia has done, it's okay, put it in plain language, it's okay if you don't provide all those rights at once, because there are so many of them, and some of them costly to provide. You only need to do it progressively over time. But Australia has had 50 years since 1976 to provide these rights. They include the right to work, the right to education, the right to the best available healthcare, social welfare, and critically, quote, adequate food, clothing and housing. Now, that housing is the one that stands out as the most well-known non-provided rights. The second thing to add, all those rights apply not just to citizens, but to non-citizens, because an article, I'll look up the number of the article, but there's an article in that covenant that says if you, as a ratifying country, are a poor country, then you don't have to necessarily provide all the expensive rights, the rights to, for example, unemployment, social welfare, education, housing. I mean, in poor countries, really only government can provide those. If you're a poor country, Covenant calls it a developing country, you were excused from providing those rights. But Australia is not a developing country. So it has to provide those rights to citizens and non-citizens. Now, that raises a separate point we'll come to, that how are non-citizens already being treated, including asylum seekers, people on visas, and what might Tony Burke, what worse might face those people under Tony Burke.
And of course, on an area like, say, your right to work, we know a lot of people are not working. They're unemployed, and indeed, the Reserve Bank says there should be more unemployed to assist with inflation or assist fighting inflation. Not enough people are sacrificing themselves enough, apparently, but then surely if that right's there but there's not enough work for those people, the government should at least provide them with a livable income, I would have thought, Max. Under these.
Well, that's right. Well, because the international covenant says that everyone's entitled to social welfare, and that includes, of course, unemployment benefits and family helpful things like single parent allowance and most notably, for older persons, the right to the age pension. Angus Taylor, you know, a few months ago announced that if he becomes Prime Minister, only citizens would get all those rights. And he seemed to be either completely unaware that he wants to be a Liberal Prime Minister, or one of his predecessors, Malcolm Fraser, signed up to a covenant that gives everyone, including non-citizens, those rights. So he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's got no right to make those proposals. But, of course, the current Labor government has deprived visa holders of those rights already. And there's a very well signed by many people, a petition going around from the Asylum Seekers Resource Centre saying because there are something like 5,000, their estimate, 5,000 visa holders in Australia who have the right to work, but they've been denied it. Their visa condition says you are prohibited from working. Now, that's shocking, and let's hope there's a reversal on that. But it looks like Burke might do worse things as well.
And indeed, the convention that Menzies signed said these people do have a right to work in this country, which we're
denying
them.
Yeah, that's right. It goes back to that, and they shouldn't be punished for if they got here, quote, unlawfully, unquote, then they shouldn't be punished for their mode of arrival. So those who came by boat, the Refugees Convention says, so long as they fess up and try and sort things out, they shouldn't be punished for coming here by boat. There's a raft of things in the Refugees Convention, in the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights that are being progressively trashed by governments of either persuasion. Just going back to housing for a moment, you would have seen the announcement last night from Michelle O'Neill from the ACTU calling on the federal Labor government to build more public housing. Did you notice that one?
I missed that one last night. No, I didn't see it. But good.
She made the point that for many years after World War II and a bit before, there was a lot of public housing being built, funded by an agreement between the federal and state and territory governments, and even as recently as under the Hawke government, we're going back, you know, a few years, but it's in recent memory, they were still building one unit of public housing for every 10 private housing constructions. That was then. Now, they're only building one unit of public housing for every 50 private housing constructions. It is shockingly inadequate, and Michelle O'Neill and the ACTU is urging them to vastly increase the ratio, and mentions a very practical thing. Nowadays, if people follow the housing construction industry, houses can be built. They don't have to be built in an old-fashioned, slow way of having usually a timber framework or metal steel framework, and then you add your walls and roof and so on. They're now being built in modular form, like the whole wall with window and door spaces is built in one unit. And there are also, she didn't mention it, but there are also small quite small houses, and many companies producing them in Australia that would fit into a big backyard on the old quarter acre blocks. And if you have a water tank and the solar panels, you're self-sufficient. They're portable. They can be delivered by truck and installed with permission, of course, of the owner. And that would fill up spacious lots in the leafy suburbs. So lots can be done. It's practicable. And good full marks to the ACTU for advocating it.
And of course, over that period, what was called public housing, so much of it has morphed into what's now called community and social housing, which is quite a different thing in many ways. And
And a recent, I think it was a Four Corners article a few weeks ago, was showing that there's good and bad in it, and the net result is that the poorer people who struggle to pay rent are being dudded with. There was a federal state, a national cabinet agreement, whereby if a private developer builds a new housing block and the any current restrictions on height, pushed by the NIMBY, not in my backyard viewpoint, well, those height restrictions would be overridden if you invoke this federal state agreement. And provided you have a certain percentage for, quote, social housing, then you can just go ahead and do it. But those social housing units, what became apparent in the Four Corners article is people can rent one of those. They don't buy it. They rent it. And their rent has to be no more than 30% of their income. But then after a year or two, the developer is allowed to replace that quite generous and reasonable allowance with a new one that says your rent, the maximum your rent pays is the maximum average rent in the area, which would be much, much higher. And so people are forced to leave the social housing they were promised. So it's a very flawed partial system. It's providing some housing, but the people who really need it are not getting much of it at all.
No, that was a very good program, actually. But also, of course, if it is straight public housing and it's only 25% of your income, which is even better.
Yes.
And the problem with social and community housing is they do tend to pick people who they think can afford to pay rather than those who, you know, really need it desperately. But, you know, there's all those
right.
problems, yeah.
You mentioned my covering letter that I sent to quite a few refugee law firms, and I'm also going to send it to the Law Council of Australia. Interestingly, some of these problems of breach of human rights can be solved if there's a Human Rights Act legislated in Australia. Now, Labor's platform says we will consider it, but Labor did more than that in the first term under Albanese, because the then Attorney General Mark Dreyfus commissioned a report into various aspects on human rights, including the possible legislating of a Human Rights Act. And the relevant committee, it's the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights, it's Senate and House, it's a representative group of parliamentarians. They recommended in 2014 that there be a Human Rights Act. Now, it's got a few flaws, which I've looked at and asked these bodies I've sent to give their opinion on it. But let me say up front that it's a very good thing in principle. In particular, not only did the Parliamentary Committee recommend there be a Human Rights Act, but they put in a brilliant provision they should be in it, and that is once the Human Rights Act has declared that X, Y, Z human rights are part of Australian law, then if someone, a citizen or non-citizen, as I say, they don't mention non-citizens, but let's go ahead, that anyone who's not getting one of those rights that are listed in the Human Rights Act can sue for, will take court action, can make a complaint to a court, say I'm in that category that should get human right X, and I'm seeking a court order that the government provide me with that right. Now, that's very powerful. At the moment, all you can do is make a complaint to the Australian Human Rights Committee and they can mediate, but they've got really almost no power of enforcement. So this would be a huge breakthrough, but Labor is not looking terribly interested in passing a Human Rights Act at the moment.
So 2024, in fact, it was May, so it's, what, 2.5 years ago almost now.
Yes.
That Mark Dreyfus report said we should have an act, and yet, well, you know, I suppose you've just made the point, but we haven't got the act. They're not doing it.
Yes, and it's getting more urgent because, as I was mentioning earlier, a recent legislation, drastic home affairs legislation, deprived people of the right to be even notified they're about to be deported. So, you know, you're an asylum seeker, or you've got a visa, it's just been cancelled, and so you're about to be deported, but you don't get notice. So you haven't got a chance to contact a lawyer and challenge the impending deportation. All happens at maybe at night. They just knock on your door and take you away. Now, I think that two things about the enactment of a Human Rights Act. One, it would, as I say, enable people to go to court and get their rights. But also, I think just the fact that it's there and it's declared that human rights, certain human rights are now part of Australian law, I think whichever government is in force will be thinking twice about whether they try and remove any of those rights, because they're now legal, enforceable, not just on a wish list that goes back to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948.
Mm. Well, we saw you mentioned the Four Corners program on housing, but there's also one last week, of course, about virtual slave labour. Don't know if you saw it, but it talked about, for instance, fruit pickers and vegetable pickers in Australia, mostly brought in from islands, from New Guinea and the islands around Pacific, and the total exploitation of those workers who are locked into, say, one employer. If they leave, they're virtually stateless here in Australia, and they're here illegally if they refuse to keep working for someone who's exploiting them. I mean, that's an area where surely there need to be some human rights respected.
Well, that's now it's interesting that the draft act put forward by the parliamentary committee suggests that the list of human rights conventions, treaties and so on, has only got 10 items on it. They're important. But I've just been reading overnight the very interesting document put out by the Law Council of Australia. It's called Human Rights and the Legal Profession, Key Principles and Commitments. Now, it's addressed mainly to lawyers, but it mentions, for example, that list of 10 key human rights instruments, treaties, conventions and so on, it doesn't include any labour law decisions that Australia has ratified, including, I'll just mention one that's a bit related to what you just said. In 2006, Australia ratified what's called the Worst Forms of Child Labour Convention that had been made by the UN in 1999. Now, that and other labour law conventions, because there are over 100 of them that Australia has ratified, they don't get a mention in the list of human rights conventions and so on. So, to a large extent, those labour law rights have been enacted in, for example, the Fair Work Act, but not all of them, and the as you're pointing out, the enforcement of them is very weak and it leaves people, as the Four Corners article mentioned, is exposed. So there's a lot needed to be done to fix things up. I'll mention one more point if I
if there's time, Kevin.
Yep. Okay, Max. Yep.
The recommendation from the Parliamentary Committee said that if there have been cases in the past where the government has destroyed or weakened human rights, then the government should bring these to the attention of Parliament to get those rights restored. Well, excuse me, it was the government that took them away. So what I recommend is that the Parliamentary Committee, the Human Rights Joint Parliamentary Committee on Human Rights, should be the one to trawl through and find those rights destructions, and they could recommend that the Parliament fix them up. But if you leave it entirely to the government, nothing will happen at all.
And there are some important rights. There's rights of discrimination against women, your own political rights, there's rights of the child, there's rights of people with disabilities, Indigenous people, so they're all important, and we should have them. We should have them as part of our law, surely.
Absolutely, and it just to quote from the Law Council's outline of it, it just mentions that it's sort of generally accepted that now that. I won't go into too much. They quote the High Court case that says, unless and until these international covenants, treaties, whatever they're called, are part of Australian law, we, the High Court, cannot enforce them. And that's why we need a Human Rights Act.
Yeah, and the High Court, of course, is... Well, the High Court has found, you know, I think following that Abbott change, the High Court, in fact, or might have been a lower court, I can't remember which court now, but there was a case where someone was going back to persecution, but they said, well, that was irrelevant based on that Abbott legislation you said earlier, which...
That is exactly right. I can't remember the name of the case. It was about a year ago. And not only did they say it's well known protection against refoulement is, quote, irrelevant, but we, the High Court, have accepted that, and it's now something we are quite well used to. So it's not only been trashed by the Abbott government, despite the modifications to it, since it's still there, and the High Court is still saying, well, we don't have to take refoulement into account. Yeah. Just go ahead with it.
Yeah, it's another issue, Max, but doesn't that say something about the separation of powers as well in many ways?
for another discussion, maybe, Kevin.
Absolutely. Okay, look, we are out of time, Max, but look, thanks for your time today and keep up the good work.
Thank you, and likewise to you.
Okay, right, thanks a lot. Thanks. Max Costello there, who's a human rights lawyer, and I don't think he's practising anymore, but he's certainly still working hard and trying to get these things done.
Keeping on top of it all.
Yeah, and next week, we've got a fifth Wednesday, I'm trying to think. What's the date today?
You're asking me.
Oh, no, it's next week's the 4th. It's a fourth Wednesday anyway. We haven't got a fifth. Doesn't matter. Next week's a fourth, so we'll have something on next week.
We will be here. We will be back.
That's right.
9 o'clock on a Wednesday morning.
Absolutely no idea what, but we'll have something on next week. And look, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And helping us out. And of course, Joe Toscano is in the next studio, I presume. Did you turn up yet behind me? I've seen him
walk in.
Radio.
Yes.
He's ready to go on with Anarchist World this week, and we're ready to get out of here and come back with City Limits next week.
3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.